Grade 7 Conference, Lecture 34, Medieval History, Part 5. Continuing with the story of Joan of Arc. So, of course, as is well known, this young maiden in her armor with her sword and her standard was able again and again to lead French troops to incredible victories and to release Orléans from its siege, to be able to go all the way to Rheims, where she saw within a matter of months King Charles finally crowned as she said he was meant to be. And again and again, however, when the strategizing was taking place and plans were being made for the next course of action, the next battle, Joan encountered remarkable passivity on the part of the king and remarkable lethargy on the part of his military leaders and his main advisors. It was as though they lacked the will to put France where it was meant to be, as the lord and liege of its own territories. So this was very difficult for her, not only summoning up the enthusiasm to keep the troops going, which in itself was quite a task, but also to be working with commanders who were often at cross purposes to her. And after the king was crowned, the passive forces seemed to take the day, and Joan had to then spend much time for many months as a member of the court while the king and his advisors tried to figure out what their next step should be. She really felt that Paris could be taken, that France could be made into a whole country. But there was great conservatism about this, and perhaps even those who were secretly aligned with the English or the Burgundians in one way or another played a role in this. But Joan was miserable. Nothing was happening. She and her whole family had been ennobled after Christmas by the king. So from that time on, in perpetuity, they would have the name of the Lily family because of the lilies on her standard. But she wanted to act. And in one battle in which Paris was fought over, once again, probably it could have been won, even though there were some military errors made, but a treaty was hastily signed between the French forces and the Burgundians, the pro-English forces. And interestingly, it was signed in the Cathedral of Saint-Denis, of which we heard hearing about Eleanor and her work. So these things weakened Joan. They also lowered her prestige. She's now lost a battle, and she's clearly not in the innermost circle of the king and his advisors. And when she finally then said, we've got to fight, we've got to keep fighting, and threw herself into battle, it was by no means the same level of support or enthusiasm for her work. She was told by her voices that she had a year to go. That was all that she had. So she knew that victory upon victory must follow. And so she ended up then being in a battle where she and her 500 men were greatly outnumbered. When they wanted to go back into the city, the gates had been opened for them to return, and the gates were accidentally, probably, possibly purposely closed, so there was Joan and just a few men, open and vulnerable. And because she always wore a long kind of silk scarf so that she could be seen clearly by her men, that made it easy for the enemy to pull her off her horse. And now they had her. Should also be mentioned something that isn't often discussed, that we're talking now also about a battle being fought with cannons. Not yet rifles, but cannons. Now, certainly the trajectories of these cannons were anything but accurate, and they were sometimes more trouble than they were worth, but horses were not used to this, and soldiers were not used to these explosions being hurled at them. And so this, too, was a sudden disadvantage for the French. And the way in which Joan was fighting, she was following the medieval rules of battle, you know, charge forward on horseback, and may the stronger, more determined group win. Now suddenly, there was a weapon that made the lofty castles that much more of a target, that made the sturdiest walls around them easily penetrated and broken through. So it wasn't only that Joan's particular destiny was at work here, but suddenly the entire face of warfare was being changed, and a very different kind of battle would have to take place. So she was captured and put in the custody, of course, of those who were most hostile to her, and who knew that in one way or another they could use the tools of the Inquisition and in some way find her guilty of converse with the devil. And certainly this was to happen. There's no question that the French had enough high-ranking captives who were of great value to the English and the Burgundians, that some kind of trade could have been arranged. It could have happened. And yet, there again, this passive king, who had obviously the most ambivalent relationship to Joan, was unable to act. And probably many of his advisors themselves, feeling animosity towards her, told him to do nothing. So the die was cast, and Joan was imprisoned under horrible circumstances. She could have been put in a church prison where there would have been women attending to her. Instead, she was thrown into a criminal prison where English guards watched over her and undoubtedly tormented her and threatened her with all manner of things. And what's remarkable, what follows the trial of Joan of Arc, this is the most carefully documented event that had ever occurred on the face of the earth up until that time. We're used to long transcripts today of just about everything and every word of testimony being taken down by the court stenographer or whatever. Nothing like this had ever occurred before. In Latin, every question Joan was asked, every answer she gave, every word spoken, everyone's testimony, all of Joan's protests and justifications, it's all down there in writing. And it's no wonder then that the trial of Joan of Arc has been such a popular theme for playwrights, great and minor, and also for film as well, resulting in some of the Alexander Dreyer's Joan of Arc, one of the great masterpieces of the silent film, and films with sound that have followed as well. Also adding to her iconographic stature that we know so much about her. There is so much incredible detail. And then she was Interestingly enough, she was at first, the charges were mostly dropped, even though her enemies were trying her. They had to acknowledge that she was pretty much blameless of any kind of heresy. She had to sign a document which she could not read because she was illiterate in exchange for being granted the right for lifelong imprisonment rather than death. And then things were set up in such a way that she was told she could never wear men's clothing again, and that seems to have been the only clothing made available to her, which she wore. She was quickly accused of being a lapsed heretic. So it's very interesting how this trial went and how they had to finally frame her in order to be able to justify the death sentence and have her burned at the stake. And of course it said that the guards who had watched over her, the soldiers responsible for arranging the burning at the stake, they themselves wept when they saw who she was in these last moments. And it was just 25 years later that, at the insistence of her family, a second trial was held, in absentia for Joan, of course, in which the first trial was invalidated, and Joan was held to be innocent of the crimes of which she was accused. This followed over time with her canonization, and then finally her beatitude, where she was made a saint. When was Joan of Arc made a saint? You'd think, okay, she died in 1431, I don't know, 1475, 1500, 1909. That's how long it took for the church to acknowledge in full who Joan was. Quite remarkable, quite interesting. So she died at age 19. Now, this is a time that Rudolf Steiner and anthroposophists, especially interested in astrosophy and in so-called star work, have identified as the first moon node, a time when the sun and the moon and the earth are on a certain planar relationship to one another, which only happens every 19 years or so. So that is to say that they will have returned to where they were, to that particular position, when you were born, and they return to it when you are around 18 and three quarters, nearly 19 years of age. And this is a time, certainly, and the rhythms within that time, but the 18 and a half, 19-year-old time, this is a time where, for all of us, it's as though the spiritual world opens a door and says, do you want to return? It's not surprising that it's an age very high in suicides, that it's an age very high in sudden, surprising terminal illnesses appearing out of the blue, severe accidents, a time when a door opens. And we might say that Joan already knew about this. She had been forewarned that that door would open and she would have to enter it. So, a very powerful, significant individual. And I think it's very good to keep reminding your students as you go through all of her experiences, particularly those when she's on trial, of how young she was. That this is someone who never got out of her teens. And look at what she was able to accomplish. And look at what the world did to her. Very powerful lessons can really be learned here. And it's not surprising that her life and death make such popular class plays, generally performed in grade 7. So Joan, in a way, even though she belongs to the Middle Ages in certain respects, definitely she's a figure who speaks very strongly to the seventh grader.